Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, wrap them in books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And first of all, Happy New Year. This is our first show of 2018. So may this year bring you lots and lots of good books. And we're starting the year with a gothic feel. Our studio guest today on Bookmark is Laura Purcell, talking about her wonderfully spooky novel, The Silent Companions. We'll also hear from Samantha Ellis on her biography of Anne Bronte. And Nicola Upson will be talking about her new crime novel, Nine Lessons. So, Laura, hello, welcome to Bookmark.
Hi.
Nice to have you with us. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but I was absolutely thrilled, actually, when I picked up your book and thought, a chance to read a really good ghost story, because it seems to me there aren't many around. Do you think
it's brilliant for this time of year, I think? Yes. Everyone wants to settle down with like a log fire and a good ghost story. I don't think they really go out of fashion. I know the market has been kind of full of thrillers and crime books at the moment, but I think an enduring ghost story is something that stays with us. And we always wonder about life after death. It's an enduring part of the human condition. So I think the ghost story will always be in fashion.
And is the one ghost story that stayed with you?
Yes, I remember reading Susan Hill's The Woman in Black, which is a brilliant ghost story. And I think that stayed with me even more because I went to see the stage play when I was a teenager. And it is absolutely frightening. It scared the life out of me. So I think that one's always going to stay with me.
There's quite a canon as well, isn't there, of ghost stories? I mean, you've got Edgar Allan Poe, of course, M.R. James.
Yeah.
M.R. James.
I think when you start looking into it, I hadn't written a ghost story before The Silent Companions. And I thought I was going to read up lots of them. Like you said, the canon before I started. As I started digging into it, you realise just how many are out there and how many good ones as well.
So I have to ask you, given that we're going to be talking all things ghosty, do you believe in ghosts?
I'm open to believing. I don't really have any reason to believe at the moment, but I don't discount the possibility.
OK, we'll leave it at that. Well, we'll start with your first choice of music, which is Poison by Alice Cooper. Why this one?
Well, my book is set in the Victorian era, and I've also been researching another book I'm writing, which will be out this year, 2018, called The Corset. And I've been researching a lot of Victorian true crime about poisoners and arsenic, so this one seemed appropriate.
That's Alice Cooper and Poison Fading Away. That's Blown the Cobwebs Away. That's the first choice of music today from our studio guest, Laura Purcell. Laura's biopic novels, Queen of Bedlam and Mistress of the Court, are the first in a series covering the lives and loves of the Georgian-era queens. Queen of Bedlam was shortlisted for Best Historical Romance 2014 and was editor's pick in Historical Novels Review. Last year saw the publication of The Silent Companions. The Sunday Express described it as a deliciously creepy ghost story, and The Times Literary Supplement said it was a true page-turner, neatly crafted and compelling, with a spine-tingling revelation every few pages. I must say, I loved it too.
Oh, thank you.
Let's just rewind. We will spend a lot of time talking about The Silent Companions, but let's just rewind a little bit. So, Queen of Bedlam and Mistress of the Court,
yes.
Biopic novels. What's a biopic novel?
Well, this is based on someone's real life. So although it's historical fiction, it's fiction very closely based on truth. So I tried to keep it as authentic to the real lives of these queens as I possibly could. Obviously, I couldn't really know the conversations that they had. It's telling their life stories through some very turbulent times of history, actually.
And this is the Hanover period, which, remind me, is what years?
Yes, so it goes from a long way. So you've got, I mean, George the First up to William the Fourth. So, you know, you're going from the 1700s all the way up until 1837.
Yeah, it's very turbulent.
So, yes, it changes a lot. So Queen of Bedlam was about George the Third, mainly about his wife and daughters and how they coped with the effects of his illness. And then Mistress of the Court dealt with Henrietta Howard, mistress to George the Second. And she had a very interesting life, escaping an abusive marriage to the Georgian court, where she wasn't treated much better, actually.
What was it that attracted you to that particular period?
I love that period in history. It's my favourite. I think mainly from my love of Jane Austen, who was kind of smack bam in the middle of George III, George IV. And also other stories from that era. I'm thinking Hornblower and the Sharp novels, Scarlet Pimpernel. I really love it. And I'd read a lot of historical fiction books about Tudor queens, but nothing about the Hanoverians. So I wanted to start bringing those stories to some other people.
So it was a pleasure for you to research that period then,
I imagine. It's a lot of research, but I love it. You can get lost there.
And how much did you feel able to veer from the truth? It's always a tricky line, isn't it?
Yeah, I tried not to do anything that didn't feel emotionally true to the people I'd got to know. And if something happened in their life, I didn't mind putting it earlier or later, because at least it had actually happened. But it's a lot harder than when you write your own novel, because you can't just say something's not working and change their backstory or change what happens later on.
So how did you get from there to The Silent Companions then?
So I was writing my Hanoverian Queens, and that's something I still want to do at some point in my life. But I got a bit stuck. I was writing about Maria Fitzherbert, who was mistress, secret wife to George IV. And she's really fascinating. I'd done loads of research, but I was just struggling with the writing of the novel. And I just happened to come across a silent companion, which are these wooden
fire screens.
These are real things. My friend sent me a picture of one from a stately home that she was at. It's like a fire screen that looks like a person painted. I think I described them in the book as like a portrait that's been cut out and mounted on wood. That's the closest I can.
Yes. I thought a little bit of those things at seaside places where there's a hole in that you stick your head through.
But yeah. that's like that, but more antique.
definitely more sinister.
Yes. So I saw these and I thought they were terrifying. You know, I've always had a bit of a thing for sort of dolls and scary things like that. I thought they were really terrifying, and I hadn't heard of them. So I started to do some research on them. And just to sort of refresh my mind, really, I thought, I'll try and write something scary. I've never done that before. I'll throw myself into this, and maybe that will get the writing juices flowing again. And it did.
And they were called silent companions, were they?
They were. They were also called dummy boards. Some people called them fire screens. But one of the terms for them was silent companions. And I just thought, that's such a creepy name that really works for a novel. And obviously I tried to explore other meanings around that in my book.
And they are the sort of weeping angels of the book.
Yes,
very much.
They're very much like weeping angels.
For people who haven't read the book, just give us a brief resume without giving anything away, which is hard.
Yes, it is hard. Okay, so set mainly in the Victorian era, my book, and it follows a lady called Elsie, who's recently married a man above her station, but 3 months after the marriage, he's sadly died, and she has to go to his country estate called The Bridge, which is, of course, crumbling and decayed and spooky, to oversee his funeral arrangements. While she's there, some strange things start to happen, and she discovers a 200-year-old diary and one of these silent companions that looks a little bit like her.
Yes, yeah, and you say, of course, it's crumbling. Yes, you do have all the tropes there, don't you? There's the big house, the mysterious death, the locked door. Were you aware that you know you needed to put these in? I mean, it's slightly ironic, but it works as well.
Yes, I wanted the Silent Companions really to be like a loving ode to the genre, because I do enjoy these novels, and I think there's a certain expectation when you read one. But I tried to do some different things, and play on some ideas.
Yes, you undercut it, sir. But it is very much a homage to those Gothic.
Yes, absolutely.
Did you have to read a lot? It must have been wonderful.
Yes, I had read quite a lot. I'd read quite a lot of Anne Radcliffe, who was an early mistress of the Gothic. And I started to read. My husband's a big Stephen King fan, so I decided I was going to read his ghostly stories. I mentioned Susan Hill, Michelle Paver, M.R. James. I read loads of ghost stories. I was scared of my own shadow by the end of it.
Well, I suppose the Brontes do fit into that.
Yes.
We're moving to Anne Bronte now, but Jane Eyre very much, you know, The Locked Door. Yes. And The Tenant of Wildfell Hall by Anne Bronte, obviously.
I'm so glad there's going to be a biography of Anne Bronte, another one, because she is often overlooked and I think she's wonderful. But all the Bronte sisters have, you know, wonderfully Gothic undertones in the landscape. And just Wuthering Heights in particular has always played a large part in my imagination.
Oh, well, we're going to come back to Wuthering Heights right at the end. But thank you. You've led me very nicely to the interview with Samantha Ellis. Samantha is a playwright and author. She's had plays staged at the Edinburgh Fringe and broadcast on Radio 4. Her first book, How to Be a Heroine, was published in 2015. Take Courage and Bronte in the Act of Life came out last year and weaves together Samantha's own life with that of the youngest Bronte sister. I met Samantha when she came to talk at the Cambridge Literary Festival in November last year and asked her if she agreed that Anne was the most mysterious of the Brontes.
Yes, I really think she is. I mean, we know less about her even than Branwell, who never really left. I mean, he's left hardly any work. He was barely published, you know, a few poems here and there. Anne published two novels, one of which was a bestseller at the time that she died. And yet there's very little known about her and very little left of. There are only five letters, for example. So it's very hard to get a real picture of who she was.
So when you've got so little left of her, you've got the novels and the letters, how do you go about researching it? You know, how much do you mine that? How much do you draw from each word?
Well, I mean, there are also some diary papers that she wrote with Emily. They wrote them together, and then a couple of them she wrote on her own. They used to seal them up in a box and then open them again 4 years later when it was time to write the new one to see where they'd sort of got to. So there's those. There's a lot of evidence about things around her, because of course she was living in the house with Charlotte, who's much more well documented because she survived the others and because she was famous in her own lifetime. So we know what Charlotte was doing, and Charlotte obviously talks about her sisters. They were at school together for almost 2 years, so we know all of that. We know a lot about where she works. There's a lot around her, so there are sort of educated guesses to be made, but I think there's a certain amount of imagination that goes into any biography, because you don't ever really know, and people do destroy things before they die, or they're destroyed afterwards. In Anne's case, we don't know if she destroyed stuff. I think she probably did. Or whether Charlotte destroyed things, which may also have happened. I think there's always an element of guesswork and imagination. I think that's all right, you know, because there is when you get to know a real person as well. You don't see the whole of them. You have to slightly fill in the gaps.
And what drew you to her in particular?
Well, I'd always been an Emily fan growing up. I was obsessed with Wuthering Heights, and I wanted to try and meet Heathcliff and find love on the moors, and I had a sort of passionate attachment to that novel. My first book, How to Be a Heroine, was sort of about getting over Wuthering Heights, really. And I was a little bit ashamed, because although I sort of spent a lot of time thinking about Charlotte and about Jane Eyre in that book, didn't really mention Anne at all. And I was in Haworth doing a reading from that first book, and they said to me, do you want to look at some Bronte treasures? And of course you want to look at some Bronte treasures. So I went into the passage the next day and they said, here's Anne's last letter. And to be honest, I wasn't that interested in looking at it, because I had a very clear image of Anne from everything I'd read, and she was sort of the boring one. She was meek. She was. Charlotte had said that she was preparing for an early death, as though she never really committed to life. I thought, I was heard she was untalented. I'd never really had much time for her, but that was also the impression I was very much given from what I had read. So there I was, and I thought, oh, well, I'll have a quick look and then I'll move on to more interesting stuff. And in this letter, this was not a woman preparing for an early death. It was written a few weeks before she died, and she wanted to go to Scarborough to try the sea cure to see if it would help because she had TB. And she was desperate for life, and she was talking about all the things she wanted to do and how she wanted to live to some purpose. And she just seemed this spirited woman, a completely different woman from who I had encountered in all the sort of reading I had done. And I thought, well, why do I have this impression of her? And I just was intrigued. I really wanted to find out more.
And do you think she suffers because she's a Bronte sister? Because if her, she's always compared to Charlotte and Emily. If she'd have written separately, if she, Bronte hadn't been her surname, she'd be more famous, do you think?
Yeah, a lot of people say that in any other family she would have been the genius, you know. But I think also it's a real shame. I mean, so her second novel, The Tenant of Wealthful Hall, it's about a woman who falls in love with a sexy, dangerous cad, like all Bronte heroines do. And then she marries him. And then the novel doesn't stop, it goes on. And it just shows the consequences of it. He becomes an abusive alcoholic and she has a horrendous time and they have a son and he starts, you know, abusing the son. And it's just horrific. And she leaves him. And this is was not just bold, it was illegal for a woman to leave her husband. She also takes the child away. It's an extraordinary, radical novel. And it was right at the sort of cutting edge of Victorian feminism. Victorian feminism at the time was all about motherhood and mothers' rights and how to give mothers more rights when they left their relationships over their children, because often the fathers would just get custody even if they were violent, abusive, drunk, unfaithful, whatever. And so it was an amazing novel, really. It was very radical. All the Brontes were called coarse and unwomanly, but the worst criticism came of The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. You know, it really was panned by absolutely everyone for being brutal, morbid, coarse, unwomanly. And when Anne died, it was a bestseller. Charlotte was the executor, and she had never liked the novel. She didn't like the fact that it was, in some places, a thinly veiled portrait of Branwell and his alcoholic decline. He had had an enormous impact on his family and it had been really hard to live in the house with him, and Charlotte wasn't happy about that. She had dropped her pseudonym, she was facing the public, who were often quite hostile, and she'd always underestimated and misunderstood her sister, and she refused to allow the book to be reprinted in her lifetime, so it fell out of print very quickly from being a bestseller, and it was just impossible to get. That was a real factor. And Charlotte also wrote the sort of mini sort of biography of her sister, the sort of biographical notice, in which she said that Anne was less talented than Emily. She said that she was meek, pious, gloomy. She made her come across as quite dull, really. And she said that the novel had been a mistake. And I think that really stuck, because it was Charlotte Bronte's opinion on her sister. You know, that really stuck. So I think, unfortunately, we do have to slightly blame Charlotte.
A meek, pious, dull, gloomy, what was she like? I mean, if she came into the room now, what kind of person would she be?
So, obviously, Charlotte was there. I wasn't, so I could be completely wrong. We do know Anne was very quiet and slow to share what she was like. So, if she bounced into the room, we might not immediately get to know her. But I think she was a radical. Her first novel, Agnes Grey, which is often read as being very sweet, it was an expose of what it was really like to be a governess, as opposed to sort of the gothic fantasy of Jane Eyre. You know, it was really about how awful it was, and all three Bronte sisters had suffered as teachers and governesses, and it really put that experience on the page. Plus, also interestingly, given the current sort of climate, it was very much about the education of boys and girls, how we should educate boys to become men who would be nicer to women, and we should educate girls to understand the perils ahead. And it's extraordinary how this debate is still going on and still so crucial, and she had it all right there in Agnes Grey. The Tenant of Wealthful Hall, also completely radical. So I think she was a sort of quiet radical, you know, sort of simmering on the surface. Who knows what would have happened if she'd lived longer and been able to pursue that. The evidence was she was a very good listener. She's not a talker. If someone who'd listen a lot. She was pious. She was a real religious thinker. She thought very hard. She read the Bible all the way through when she was 19, and she made notes. And she sort of really wanted to sort of see how she felt about it herself, rather than sort of listening to anyone, including her father, who was, of course, a, you know, Church of England vicar, but she wasn't listening to him. She was sort of taking her own take on it. She's very loyal, and I think she's just got something going on the whole time, you know, something happening all the time that you might not be able to find out about, but she, you know, it is happening in there. So, yeah, I think she'd be hard to get to know, but worth it.
And you've bound the examination of Anne up with looking at your own life. Were you surprised by the similarities?
Well, I suppose I wanted to see what Anne could teach me, what it would be like to spend a year in her company. And there were lots of things that happened during that. It was 2 years, in fact, that I thought we'd never make it into the book. So I met the man I'm now married to at the beginning of the work on the book. I hadn't met him. By the end, we'd gone on our honeymoon. When that was happening, I thought, well, none of that's going to go in, because Anne never married. We're pretty sure she never had a relationship. She may have had a flirtation with a curate called William Wakeman, but we're pretty sure that she didn't have a relationship, as far as all the sort of experts, you know, that I've consulted and the sort of books have told me. But she's thought very hard about relationships and marriage, and specifically, I think she thought very hard about the difference between sort of bad love and good love. And sort of bad love is the Kathy Heathcliff love that sort of tears you apart and feels sort of all-encompassing and doesn't really leave you any space to know who you are. And it's often a kind of destructive love. And the sort of good love, which is what she was hoping for her heroines and probably for herself, where you sort of feel like your heart's expanded. She has this line about, does your heart expand to all mankind? This idea of opening up and loving a lot of people, not just the person. I thought about that a lot when I was committing to my husband, and I think it was extremely helpful, even though I had no idea that was how it was going to go.
So what next for you? Are you going to carry on writing another biography in the same form? Or?
Well, I'm also a playwright. I've just written a radio play that's going to be on, I think, in February, which is about a production of Love's Labour's Lost that happened in Afghanistan in 2005. So that's quite different. A lot about love in that too, I suppose, but it's quite a different piece. And I've had a baby, so I'm having a little bit of a breather.
That's allowed.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that is allowed. Take Courage, Anne Bronte and the Art of Life by Samantha Ellis is published by Chatto & Windus. Our studio guest on Bookmark today is Laura Purcell, author of The Silent Companions. Laura, Samantha talking there about those Victorian ideas of motherhood, which you also explore in The Silent Companion, and the Victorian ideas of women generally.
I think there was a big shift when we were saying from Georgian mothers towards Victorian mothers. There became this idea of the woman as the angel in the home, who was, you know, the all-caring mother, the loving wife. And actually, that was a huge pressure upon women. I think maybe more in the Georgian era, they'd been mothers, they'd loved their children and had been expected to manage them. But children weren't the centre of the household in a way that they became in the Victorian era. And with that, I think the sort of household manager side of the woman's role shifted to be a lot more maternal.
And also this idea that a woman, a difficult woman, I use the quotation marks when I say that, was hysterical or somehow mentally ill.
Yes, there's always nervous fevers, this idea of the woman that swoons all the time. And it seems to happen a lot more in Victorian novels than actually Victorian historical research. When you look at the real women in the Victorian era, they're a lot more sturdy than Dickens would have you believe. But yes, there was that idea that women's ideas could be dismissed as fancies, as whims, as hysteria. And I think that's something that Wilkie Collins really explored in The Woman in White.
And in The Silent Companions, I want to say you've got three narrators. You actually have two, but...
No, I know what you mean, yeah.
One of them is an old version of the character, and one is the young, and they do feel very different. How did you write that? Did you write it chronologically or chapter after chapter? Did you follow one person's story all the way through before going back for another?
I did write it as three separate narratives. I had in my mind how they would interlink, and I made a list of all the scenes I wanted to write. Wrote as three separate narratives, then kind of made a plan on what scenes were going to link where I was going to cut in, and then had to go through it all to make it smooth. But I think because it does cut between time periods, I wanted each narrative to have a very distinct feel so people weren't confused about what time they were reading in.
And it's lovely the way, and surprising how they overlap. And they all, there's no confusion because they all feel very different. How did you find each one's voice?
Yeah, I really enjoyed writing another Anne, actually. I've got a character called Anne who is a former mistress of the bridge and lived there in the 1600s, which is a period that I hadn't done a lot of research into before. So I really enjoyed exploring her voice. She's a herbalist. She's rich, she's well-bred, but she's got this sort of darker undercurrent, and I really enjoyed exploring her. And the third part of the book is set at an asylum. And that was fun as well. I think I did a lot of research into Victorian asylums and I had them in my mind that they were these terrible, scary places. But actually, my research showed they were a lot kinder than we've been led to imagine. So that was something that was fun to write about as well.
Well, we're going to come back to those. There's three really key locations in the book. We'll come back and talk to you about that. But we'll go to your second choice of music now, which is The Disturbed and The Sound of Silence. Why this one?
I always loved this song, the Simon and Garfunkel version. It was brilliant. And then around the time I was writing The Silent Companions, I heard this version. It tied in with the title and it just blew me away.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again. Because a vision softly creeping left its scenes while I was sleeping. And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspiration.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers, and our studio guest, Laura Purcell, author of The Silent Companions. Laura, we were talking there about the locations of the book. There's three, really, aren't there? There's the Match Factory, the Asylum, and the House, the Bridge.
Yes.
And they're all linked. I don't want to give too much away, but they are.
they're kind of linked through my heroine, Elsie, yes.
Yes, and they're linked with the theme of wood, I suppose. Like
yes.
So, The Match Factory, particularly interesting. How much research did you do into that?
Yes, I did a lot. In an early version of the book, Elsie didn't work at a match factory. She met someone that worked at a match factory. It's a Victorian institution that's always fascinated me, I think mainly because of this terrible disease called Fossey Jaw, which was part of the phosphorus poisoning that happened to the workers. And obviously, as the Bryant and May strike later went on to show the terrible conditions they'd been working in. So I had this idea that I wanted to have a match factory owner that was more conscientious and actually cared about her workers. And it just fed in beautifully with the Silent Companions and their wooden nature. And when I'm going back to Anne in the 1600s, she's got a bit of a fascination with fire. It all seemed to link very nicely. So,
yes, I mean, reading about the Match Factory, obviously from a modern day perspective, we know how poisonous it is. And it gives a sort of irony to
yes.
Elsie's benevolence that she thinks she's been kind to these people. And we know what kind of legacy she's leaving them with, really.
Absolutely. And I think that's something that becomes clear when you're researching the past and makes you think about your actions today. Actually, there's sometimes even the most well-intended things can yes. end up being dangerous.
Yeah, well, how conscious were you of that modern day perspective? Because readers now are very savvy with the genre of the ghost story. We know if there's a locked door that it's going to be unlocked, faces at the window, etc. How much were you trying to second guess your reader?
Yes, I'm always aware that I'm writing for a modern audience. And I always like to play with people's expectations. So, you know, there were some things where there were some people that perhaps would have been expected to be innocent that I hopefully turned it around a little bit. But it is hard. You're right. We're very intelligent readers now. And actually, my husband, whenever he watches television with me, he always guesses the twists in about the first 5 minutes of a show. So, yeah, you've got to be careful. It's hard. It's hard to deliver on that surprise as an author.
Well, I suppose if the plot can't surprise, it's the pacing and the suspense. And there's a lot of that in The Silent Companions. How do you write that? I mean, can you pin it down to...
It's very difficult. And it's something I think I maybe learnt from all the books of the same genre I was reading. But I think restraint and patience is the main thing holding back. I mean, gradually ramping up, obviously, at the end, you know, you do want that thrilling, heart-pounding, got to find out what happened next. But I think the very slow reveals to start with and the sense of creeping dread just helps to build the pace up to that climactic moment.
And all that research you did reading other ghost stories, were you able to learn from that?
I think I did subconsciously. I mean, I didn't take any examples and say, oh, they did this, I'm going to do that. But I think, you know, I sort of learned from some of the masters what they were doing and watched what they did and tried to do a bit myself.
Well, you did very well. We're going to take a little sidestep now, not a massive sidestep, but we're going to speak to Nicola Upson now. Nine Lessons by Nicola Upson is the seventh crime novel featuring Josephine Tay as the main character. Set in Cambridge, as the city's women are gripped by the fear of a serial rapist, the novel pays homage to the golden age of crime fiction in the 1930s and 40s, yet it also has a modern twist to it. So I asked Nicola how hard it was to mix the two.
Quite easy, really, because the Golden Age, if we're talking about the style of fiction as opposed to the actual time, is something that I absolutely love. So it's always important to me to honour those books, to honour the sense of mystery and plotting and puzzle and suspects and red herrings that readers of those books tend to love. But I can't write Golden Age novels because obviously I live in a completely different time. And also I'm helped in that really by the fact that Josephine Tay, the lead character, was also a woman who was far ahead of her time. So she was quite modern in her independence and her outlook and her attitudes. So traversing those wonderful years, which saw such milestones like, you know, the coronation, the abdication before that, and obviously sandwiched in between those two world wars, was quite something. And also I find when I go back to look at things that feature in my books, like the early days of the BBC or the early days of the film industry in past books, they're always more modern than you think they are. I mean, we think we've invented absolutely everything in this day and age, but even something like The Death of Lucy Kite, one of my books that went back to the Red Barn murder, that practically invented tabloid journalism. So I think maybe when we're thinking of that time, it's we're the ones who should perhaps give it a bit more credit for being more up to date than we necessarily think it is.
And the Red Barn murder there, that was a real murder that took place.
It was.
And you're referencing in this book a series of brutal attacks that really took place. How hard was it to go back to that? Because it wasn't very nice dredging up all that.
No, not at all. And we're talking about the Cambridge rapist, which lots of people listening to this will still remember to this day, because I found very much researching that the fear of those time, 1974 to 75, when Peter Cook terrorised the city by brutalising a series of women, increasingly vicious attacks. And he became known as a legend, really, the Beast of Bedsit Land. And it wasn't so much that I wanted to do. I didn't want to harp on the rapes themselves, because I think that would be gratuitous and wrong. But I did want to explore how Cambridge as a town fell under the siege of this single man, the fear, the way that you can walk round the city now and still see bars at some ground floor windows that were put in there. It was quite easy because Mandy, my partner, was living in Cambridge at the time of the rapist. She was running a music club in the Anchor pub. And when Peter Cook's picture started to appear in the papers after he was caught, she realised that she knew him. He worked for a wine merchant and he would deliver supplies to the pub every week and she would serve him half a pint of Whitbread tankards. So she told me a lot about that time. And the thing that she told me that struck me most actually was a piece of advice that young women were given, which was when they left for work in the morning, they were to open all their wardrobe and cupboard doors, because if they got home in the evening and any one of those doors was shut, they knew something was wrong, and just to get the hell out of the house. So it was that kind of atmosphere that I wanted to imagine myself back into, the randomness of it, the idea that the man who was raping these women could be the taxi driver who took you home, or the ambulance driver, or the man you stood next to in a cinema queue. And all those things transferred remarkably easily back to the 1930s, because it's all about human attitudes and human reactions, the suspicion that fell on the innocent men and the growing resentment about that. The police, you know, even the 1970s, there was no specific way to treat rape. So the attitudes of that, the attitudes of the newspapers, who would use words like ravished, which kind of sounds like something out of a bad romantic novel, something faintly desirable. So it was all those kind of social things that were interesting to me, rather than Peter Cook himself. And I also wanted to look at the aftermath of that crime, because in all the books I read and the research I did and the people I spoke to, that was something that struck me very clearly, is that after you are raped, you're never the same again. It doesn't just finish when the culprit gets caught.
This is an added responsibility if you're talking to people who've been traumatised by these things and for whom dredging up these memories might be difficult.
Yes.
As a writer, that takes your responsibility further than the page.
It certainly does. And I think because the crime novel, by the whole nature of the genre, is all about the perpetrator. It's guessing the name of who done it. And it tends to be the name of the criminal that stays in our mind. I mean, that again was something that struck me very forcibly going back to Lucy Kite, because Mariah Martin, when she was killed by William Corder, she kind of just lost her identity as a living, breathing woman before she became the victim or the whore in that crime. And when you think that so close to where Mariah Martin was killed, 200 years later, Steve Wright killed 5 women from Ipswich. We know his name. You and I can probably bring his face to mind. And yet, how many of us could actually name all 5 of his victims? So I think that's something important that the crime novel can do. I mean, obviously, it's got to be an entertainment and hopefully a good read. But it's also got to honour and remember the people who are at the heart of that, and that's the victims of murder or the survivors of rape. I won't call those victims, because hopefully those women went on to lead fulfilling lives. And the book actually is dedicated to them, to the women who survived the real Cambridge rapist.
And I'm wondering what it is in you that's drawn to crime. You seem a very nice person to me, and yet you've described some gruesome murders. What is it about that that interests you? Is it a different side of your psyche and you just park, obviously, you just park, hopefully, when you're not writing?
Well, I think when it comes to the murders themselves, and there are some nasty ones in this book, there is a kind of, I don't know, that there is a competitive edge amongst crime writers, I think. You all have a benchmark about the nastiest crime you've ever read. And for me, it's P.D. James's Shroud for a Nightingale in that nursing college. If you've read that book, you'll know exactly what I mean. So there is that kind of thing. But I also think if you're going to write about crime, it's got to be quite real, not gratuitous, but it's got to be quite high stakes. It's got to matter. And I do think that running through all my books, I like to make the death of somebody also very much about their life. I like it to refer back to who they were before they became the corpse in my novel. So I think for that, and up to the last couple of books, actually, I've always killed people I like as characters, you know, because I think the sense of loss has got to affect the reader. It's got to be more than a bit a puzzle now. Although I love the Golden Age, sometimes I do think it's a bit mechanical, it's a bit formulaic, and the emotions that actually lie behind what they're describing are sort of fussed over and gone and a bit shadowy, which is why I like Josephine Tay, because she never does that. So it is to do with that, but also I think it's about unravelling people's lives and how they relate to each other. And the story, although the murders and the crimes are pivotal, they're very important to the structure of each book, and they're very important to why people read them. But actually the background and the bits I love best is how the living people relate to each other.
And Josephine Tay is your heroine. This is your 7th novel,
yes,
with her, and
yes,
she's obviously still interesting you.
She is. You know, the more I get to find out about her, because the research into her life goes on, the more I want to explore it, because she was a woman who was living in a fascinating time. I mean, that period of social change for women from sort of just before the First World War, leading up to the Second and the aftermath, which is the span of her adult life, is a fascinating time, I think, and I love exploring that. But also, she's a bit ahead of it. She lived her life in a very particular way. She often used the word chameleon to talk about herself. So she fits into different circumstances. She lived the high life in London with people like Gielgud and Olivier among her friends, because she wrote plays and had a theatrical career as well. But also then she went back to Inverness and became a very, very different sort of person altogether, quite a private person. So the gaps in her life and the differences in her personality are something that is wonderful to explore through fiction. But also, I think, you know, it's still very early in her career. We're in 1937-38 at the moment, which is before she wrote her best work. You know, the glut of crime novels that came after the Second World War, like The Franchise Affair and A Daughter of Time and Brat Farrow, those novels that people really love, they're still way into the distance. So there's quite a lot of years to look forward to.
And this has been very successful in America. I was going to say it's very British, but it's actually very English, though, would you say? And I suppose that's one of the reasons, as well as being beautifully written, for its success.
I would say it's a very English book. Somebody else described it as that quite recently, and I think that's quite odd, because Josephine Tay, her real name was Elizabeth McIntosh. She's a Scottish woman. She was very proud of her Scottish heritage, and she lived most of her life in Scotland. But the tradition that I want to honour in these novels, and the place of setting is hugely important to me. The books tend to start with something real about her life or work, but the setting is an indulgence on my part, so I write about the places I love, or I write about the places I want to get to know better. So Suffolk recurs a lot. I love exploring London back in the 30s and imagining how it was then, and most recently in Cambridge, Cornwall too as well. So yes, they are very English in their setting and their nature.
And what next for you, Nicola?
Well, I'm just starting, I'm a bit behind, but I'm just starting the eighth book in the series, which is quite interesting for me because it is split between 1938, the present of the book, but it goes back to 1915 as well and sees Josephine as a young woman of around 20 in those years of the First World War.
Nicola Epson there, talking about Nine Lessons, which is published by Faber and Faber. In the studio with me is Laura Purcell, author of The Silent Companions. Laura, Nicola's saying there that for a crime novel to work, it's got to feel real.
Yes.
I guess the same is very much true for a ghost story.
It's difficult with a ghost story, isn't it? Because it's a very fantastical idea in a way, but it also has to have a grounding in reality, or you're not going to really feel scared. I think it's about making the familiar unfamiliar, and taking your reader through a gradual process. So if you have got some more outlandish parts of your ghost or your monster, you don't want to reveal those at first. You want people to get used to the idea that it exists and then bring out the big stuff.
But it's a very sensual novel, your novel, and I guess that's part of it, isn't it? There's the smell, for example, of Hedda's herbs, and
yes,
the sounds that come from the garret, and it really taps into the reader's sensual awareness.
I think that's a big part of it. I'd read something, a lot of Victorian superstitions, and one of them was that the smell of roses foretold the coming of a ghost, and I really liked that. And I think fear does that to you. It gives you this heightened awareness of all your senses, and you notice these little things. So the more I could draw that out, I thought the more I could put the reader into that state of mind.
And your background is in bookselling.
Yes.
You worked as a bookseller.
Yes.
So you have an awareness, I suppose, of what works, what sells.
I guess I do, yes. Again, that's mainly a subconscious thing, but I used to work at Waterstones. That's where I met my husband. We both were booksellers. So, yes, I guess I see what people buy, what people like, and hopefully try and turn that to my advantage.
And your next novel, The Corset, is coming out.
Yes, I don't have a date. It's going to be in the autumn 2018, and it's about a seamstress who believes she has a supernatural power to hurt people with the clothes she makes.
Ooh.
So it's not ghostly, but it is still supernatural.
I was going to say, is this your genre now?
Yes, I've got quite a few ideas in this genre. It's one of those ones, once you start looking for scary things, the more you see. And I think especially in the past, there are some strange and scary items. and like I was saying about the match factories and things, the more you research, the more things you find that you can put a spooky twist on.
And are you a full-time writer now?
I am, yes. It's wonderful. I've always wanted to be a full-time writer, and now I'm finally getting to do it.
So how does your writing day work?
I'm probably not as scheduled as I should be. It's difficult. I'm lucky because my husband works from home as well, so I'm not that lonely. But I tend to start the day with research and reading other books to warm up my mind. And it depends, obviously, if I've got a novel out, I might be doing publicity articles and things. But I like to sit down for a good few hours in the afternoon and really flow with the first draft of something. But, you know, it can be difficult, especially if I'm writing about swirling mists and spooky things, and it'll be a bright summer's day outside, you know. Sometimes it's hard to detach yourself from what's going on around you. I don't have as much structure maybe as I should, but I find sometimes if you're too structured when you're trying to be creative, that can shut you down if you're putting too much pressure on yourself. So,
and you say you always wanted to be a writer.
Yes, I started writing when I was 14, maybe 15. It was always something I'd wanted to do full time, but obviously it's very difficult to get into. And I've always had other jobs around my writing to pay the bills. So I'm finally actually being able to pay the bills with my words.
Well, I highly recommend The Silent Companions by Laura Purcell. It's published by Raven Books. Let me, we'll come back to you in a moment, Laura. I want to find out, A, what you're reading at the moment, so I'll give you time to think about that, and B, you can talk us through your last choice of music. But on the next show, our studio guest is Tony Peake. He'll be talking about his novel North Facing, which examines the fallout from the Sharpeville massacre in South Africa in 1962. We'll also be hearing from Colin Brown about his book Operation Big, The Race to Stop Hitler's A-Bomb, and the role played by a house in Godmanchester. And former Radio Luxembourg DJ Mark Wesley will be talking about becoming a novelist and his second novel, A Frack. All the old episodes of Bookmark are on the Cambridge 105 website, cambridge105.co.uk, where you can also find podcasts from all the other wonderful shows on this station. We cover food and films and the arts. There's plenty there. Do have a look around the website when you get there. So, Laura, the killer question, it seems to flummox almost every guest. I'll give you time to think about it now. What are you reading at the moment and why?
So I'm working my way through Dickens' Christmas novels. I started with The Chimes, which is about New Year, a lesser known one of his novels. And now I'm on A Christmas Carol, which is obviously the classic. It's ghostly, but not as spooky. And also, because I'm writing in the Victorian era, it's such good research. I think Nicola said in her interview how you're always surprised by the modernity of previous texts. And I think especially with Dickens, if you look at some of the language he uses, it still feels like a very modern book to me.
And of course it's a ghost story. I mean, we'll forget that. We remember the moral side of it. Yes, but there are three, you know, not just one, but three.
Yes, and it starts to feed into this, you know, classic Victorian ghost story. The idea started to come alive at this time period. Victorians discovering spiritualism. Everything was very blurred. They were making so many discoveries that it was hard to tell what was real and what wasn't anymore. So I think they really warmed to this idea of ghosts, and if they could communicate now through telegraph wires, what's to say they couldn't communicate with the spirit world? It's a fantastic era to be reading in when you're looking at the idea of the ghost.
Well, lovely to talk to you, Laura. We're going to play out now with your last choice of music, which is Wuthering Heights. Hayley Westenra, you particularly asked for this version.
I did, because I love Wuthering Heights, but Hayley Westenra is my favourite singer, so it combines two things I love.